From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The leader of North Carolina's House of Representatives would like to see quicker action on reopening the state's economy. He believes Governor Roy Cooper's plan moves too slowly. We'll hear his ideas. Top leaders of the state's public schools realize they'll face key challenges preparing to reopen school buildings at the end of the summer. They'll share some of their concerns. A Venezuelan freedom activist joins us. He offers a warning to young people who believe the United States should embrace socialism. And we'll delve into a scathing audit of North Carolina's State Department of Transportation. DOT overspent nearly $750 million. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper's statewide shutdown order has pushed North Carolinians to embrace virtual technology for all sorts of things, everything from weddings and funerals to shopping to education and certainly health care. Could it be that this pandemic will usher in a new acceptance of what's known as telemedicine or, more broadly, telehealth issues? Well, a new paper co-authored by experts at the John Locke Foundation and the Brookings Institution takes a look at the potential and the challenges for this innovation. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst at the John Locke Foundation. He is a co-author of this report, joins us now to talk about it. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
So overall, give us a sense of how COVID-19 has impacted the adoption of this digital technology when it comes to access to healthcare and medical treatment.
Mm-hmm. So I think there's two main things. First of all, as you mentioned, the stay-at-home orders, people's access to their typical doctor's office or everything, accessing that change. So, we saw people that, they might not feel comfortable going out, may not want to go to the doctor's office for fear of contracting the disease. So they opted towards more virtual visits. And so a lot of people were talking to their doctors, getting consultations that way. But then the other reason was that, when thinking about fighting this disease, we want to keep our frontline healthcare workers as less susceptible to the disease as we can. And so if you're feeling under the weather, you think you might have some of the symptoms of COVID, checking with a doctor over a virtual visit first may, decrease the number of interactions you have with other people and make sure that if you truly have the virus, then you can get proper directions on how to get to the hospital, where to go, what to do, things like that. And, another thing is that a lot of the healthcare professionals may be in that high risk category of susceptibility to contracting the disease. So keeping them separated, allowing them to still do their job, but over virtual means was one of the ways to, decrease the amount of interactions that you might have with somebody. So a lot of those were reasons why more people started to use it, but also a lot of the regulations like we'll talk about.
One thing that I've noticed is it seems like what is different about it that I have noticed during COVID is we're kind of used to the idea of communicating with someone virtually. Mm-hmm. You can do it on your phone, you can do it on your laptop, and having a conversation. But it seems now that we've taken a step further, and perhaps more people have, where you can actually be monitored. Maybe you have a piece of equipment at your home with you where you can assist the medical professional that's joining you virtually in monitoring whether it's your blood pressure, your heartbeat, or your medication level or whatever. It seems like we've kind of added that layer to it during COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the biggest things that, as we researched this paper, we were looking for ways to, how can we increase the adoption and just a general level of comfortability with the technology and, people have, you know, generally gone to the doctor's office to get their care, and now, you know, accessing it over their iPhone or through a computer may feel a little unfamiliar or not right in a sense. And so, you know, just, you know, increasing these options have allowed people to see that, you know, it can work. It can supplement the normal delivery of care. And as people get more comfortable with it, just like new innovations all over, it becomes, you know, more widely accepted, and just, you know, people feel better about using it. They think they can get that same level of care, because a lot of times it can be provided over virtual means.
COVID has also focused us a bit more, I think, Jordan, on the issue of required technology in mm-hmm. order to do this, and broadband. And mm-hmm. there are some places in North Carolina and across the country where people don't have access to mm-hmm. higher speed technology, et cetera, mm-hmm. Particularly people who are maybe at the modest end of the income mm-hmm. scale, mm-hmm. or they live in a remote area where there might not be a private provider
right.
that gives them access to higher speed. Talk a little bit about that challenge for telemedicine and telehealth.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the greatest things about telemedicine is that it can connect people over great distances, and, you know, it really increase access for people who may not have the supply in their area. But it's only as good as, you know, your ability to connect to the other doctors and things like that. So rural broadband and, you know, just broadband access in general are huge issues because, you know, you can't connect to somebody without that. So as we look towards the future, yeah, we need to look, you know, how can we make sure that in these medically underserved communities or these medical deserts, we know that there's not enough healthcare supply in that area, but in order to bridge that gap, we need to connect people. So looking for ways to encourage, you know, private broadband companies to get out there, that's going to be really important in the future.
And that's a big challenge because what do you do if you have, let's say I'm a broadband company owner, mm-hmm. and I know that there is a need somewhere in North Carolina, but I know that, let's say it's going to cost me money, that I won't be able yeah. to make money in mm-hmm. order to do that. So that's a really tough discussion we have to have with policymakers here about how we go about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, especially in a state like North Carolina, that we have a very, very rural population, one of the, I believe, the second biggest, only behind Texas. So this is a large part of our population that we're going to try that, you know, we think that this technology can help. And so it's just part of the equation, because like I said, you know, your access to doctors over telemedicine is only good as your connectivity. So, yeah.
So connectivity, one big issue, but in the report that you co-authored with the folks at the Brookings Institution, which, by the way, is available at johnlock.org, it's also an issue of connectivity to a medical professional. Mm-hmm. There are people who are highly skilled, but as you detail in the report, Jordan, because of certain antiquated rules and things like that, I can't get access to someone who maybe is the best person in the world who knows about that rash I've got on my arm, but maybe that person doesn't technically practice in North Carolina.
Right. So, you know, telehealth, I think, you know, illustrates the problems with the way that we've, you know, unleashed this licensure system in our country. You, and in most states, you need a medical license to practice in that state, to treat patients in that state. But, you know, not every doctor wants to get a license for all 50 states. It just doesn't make sense. It's redundant and more costs and everything. And so one of the big regulations that we saw waived during the COVID-19 pandemic was a lot of these licensure requirements. So, you know, Governor Cooper and a lot of other governors waived these requirements. So, people in North Carolina can be seen by doctors from out of state because, like we see, you know, there's a maldistribution of healthcare providers. And so, you know, this genius of telemedicine allowing us to connect over long distances, these antiquated laws, as you said, limit you to just the state borders. And so that's really one of these old regulations that just inhibits people from accessing telehealth, and, you know, we should unleash it to allow it to allow patients to access it at the highest level possible.
It's curious, isn't it, Jordan, that in an emergency, our policymakers, so whether it's the governor or mm-hmm. legislators, seem to just intuitively understand, hey, this rule is an impediment, and we need to, because we're in an emergency, get rid of that thing so that we can take care of the problem that we have. Mm-hmm. seems like common sense that once we make our way through the pandemic, that they would all sit down across the table and say, you know what, if it made sense then, it makes sense now.
Absolutely. You know, the irony lies that, you know, organizations like ours at the John Locke Foundation, we've been advocating for a lot of these policies and just this, these general theoretical principles of just, you know, deregulation and, you know, just no restrictive or protectionist policies for a long time. And so, you know, going forward, I think there's no reason that we should revert back to any of these restrictive policies.
Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. The report that he co-authored with the folks at the Brookings Institution is available at johnlocke.org. Jordan, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the state's top lawmakers is going public with his desire for a quicker reopening of the North Carolina economy. During an online presentation for the John Locke Foundation, State House Speaker Tim Moore reacted to Governor Roy Cooper's lockdown orders.
When the governor ordered the first shutdown, I was supportive because I felt like, you know, there was a lot of unknown unknowns out there, and all the modeling data that we had was really painted a very dire picture of what could very likely happen. And so we did shut down like happened around most of the country, in fact, most of the world. Where we are now, though, in terms of the most recent announcement is I don't entirely agree with the governor, because I do think, for one, if you look at the phases that were discussed, there's really not much difference between where we are now and this phase one that's supposed to start on into May. And so I don't know that really is moving things down the road. Additionally, if you look at what was going to be necessary to go, say, from the phase one to the phase two to the phase three, it was pretty ambiguous, frankly. My suggestion, and I actually made this suggestion directly to the governor, was what you ought to do is to consult with all the experts that we have in the state. We have an amazing school of public health. This is what they do over at UNC, the research, and get modeling, number one, that's also real time. Because, you know, since those models came out 4 weeks ago, we've also had the benefit of, you know, finding out what's happening out there. And if you compare, for example, if you look at those models from 4 weeks and 5 weeks ago, talking about what we needed to do in the shelter in place, even if we followed those models, they all predicted much more infection, much more hospitalization, and many more deaths than what we've actually seen. So I think it's safe to see that the disease, the virus, has not spread and has not been as bad as it was thought to be in the modeling. It's clearly been bad, but it's not nearly like what it was thought to be.
Speaker Tim Moore mentioned the need for more good data.
We don't have, for example, real-time testing out there by a great amount. We don't have very accurate tracking. Those are things that should have been happening more already. The General Assembly, in fact, unilaterally, Senator Berger and myself agreed to spend $100,000 of our discretionary funds to go in with a study that actually is testing for the presence of antibodies to see, you know, that means that there are folks who've actually been exposed to it, were asymptomatic for the most part, and then have developed an immunity, at least for now. We don't know how long, but at least for now. But, you know, taking all of that data is critical. Because there's no question that where we are right now in terms of the shutdown is having significant and dire circumstances, not only for the economy. I mean, I can't overstate that enough. but also for other health issues that people are facing. I mean, when you stop elective procedures, when you stop things like mammograms, when you stop things like colonoscopies and all these other things, yeah, sure, you're not doing that right now, but that leads to other problems that folks in our population have to deal with down the road, you know, cancer treatment, heart treatment, you name it. So, you know, that's why I think we really need to have accurate data, because we're doing this under the auspices of protecting health, but we're having other health consequences by virtue of being closed.
That's State House Speaker Tim Moore speaking recently in an online presentation for the John Locke Foundation. Moore reminded his audience about the original reasoning for the economic shutdown.
Remember, the whole way or the whole premise behind the shelter in place was never about just preventing people from getting sick. It was avoiding the spike. Remember that, the curve, and not wanting to see the sudden spike. And so we've not seen that spike. We've basically seen a plateau at this point. So that does question, I think, the need for, as we go forward, for the very strict and restrictive shelter in place we have right now. So my suggestion would have been to move toward a phase like so many of our neighboring states, to do a partial reopening of the state, to do something sooner rather than later. But again, a partial reopening. We don't need to go from 0 to 100. We don't just need to say, okay, yep, it's all over, open the restaurants back up, do this. No, what you can do is you can say 50% occupancy, guarantee that you have a certain amount of distance between patrons of different groups or different households. Require, for example, that the servers wear masks, that there be extra sterilization efforts for the premises as well, for utensils and kitchen and everything else. You can do those things and you can safely start moving toward a reopening. Same, for example, with personal care services. So many things that can be done with precautions so that it's not just either turned off or turned on. And I think that highlights part of the problem with government. Government can't usually think very nimbly like that. It's either off or on. And I think the private sector, if you look at our businesses that have remained open, they have adapted, they have followed recommendations, and they've put in place safeguards so that those functions can be safely done and that they can still, people are protected, but the commerce can continue.
So what does Moore think about Governor Roy Cooper's current executive orders?
My position with the governor's directive so far is I hope he will revisit. I hope he will look at incorporating more recent modeling data and be able to be a little more robust in moving those guidelines up. And one other thing I'll mention is I do think it is appropriate to give the counties flexibility on this. This is a very different state from Manio to Murphy. I can tell you that what may be necessary here in Wake County is not necessarily what needs to be in place for Polk County or for Hyde County. You know, we've got a lot of rural counties that have no cases. And so I think that what I would hope the governor would do in these coming days is revisit that and take a more nuanced view and giving those counties more flexibility as well.
State House Speaker Tim Moore reminded his audience of the economic toll linked to the COVID-19 pandemic shutdown.
Prior to this hitting, North Carolina was enjoying some of the best economic times that it had in decades. Unemployment was the lowest it had been in many decades. Taxes are the lowest during the lifetimes of anyone that's alive now. And we had done a great job of really cutting a lot of red tape and doing a lot of things to have the economy stable. Well, we know now that we need to continue doing those good things that have helped get us where we need to be. We know that in the policies that we are putting forward, for example, that we need to make sure that we are investing where we need to invest, but also doing things like easing burdens. Everything from like permitting, licensure, these things, you know, like something as simple, for example, is your driver's license. If your driver's license is set to expire during this period of time, you don't need to be, you know, crowded in the DMV office with 100 of your closest friends shoulder to shoulder waiting to renew your license. You know, extending that out for some period of time, whether it's 90 days, 6 months, whatever it is. Things like permits, if you've gotten a permit to do something, to be able to get those extended. So you'll see a whole host of reg reform that's designed to kick in and allow that to happen right now.
Regulatory reform isn't the only issue North Carolina state government must address in response to COVID-19.
The other issue that we dealt with, of course, was the taxes. The tax deadline to pay came and went April 15th. we signaled and agreed that we felt like that needed to be extended. And so taxes do not have to be filed or paid now until July 15th, and there'll be no penalties or interest for any of that. Those are some things that we've done to kind of help from a regulatory and a tax reduction standpoint to help individuals and small businesses.
That's State House Speaker Tim Moore, Republican from Cleveland County. He recently delivered an online presentation for the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The COVID-19 pandemic shut down public school buildings across North Carolina, and it's not yet clear how public schools will operate when government officials allow them to reopen. But top education officials recently offered an update on their plans. Mark Johnson is the state superintendent of public instruction.
This last month has brought challenges for parents and educators and our students unlike any we have ever faced. Like so many of you, Dr. Cohen and I are parents of young school-age children. Your leaders standing here before you today are experiencing many of these same challenges. We all had to switch to remote learning overnight. Many of our children, especially our younger children, are working through the difficult toll of this emotional experience of this frightening time. We are all stuck at home. Every day, all day. We commend our educators, our school staff, and parents across the state as we have had to adapt immediately. But this will not be the new normal. This crisis has forced us to be reactive over the course of the last month. We will finish this year as strong as we can, and plans for next year are already underway and will be proactive in the face of this crisis. This proactive work will be bipartisan and involve the governor, the state board, the General Assembly, local education leaders, and parent, teacher, and student advisors. Thank you all for your strength and resilience during these difficult times. Together, we will come out of this crisis stronger.
Eric Davis chairs the State Board of Education. He offered his own assessment of the current state of North Carolina's public education.
We are now, more than ever, resolute in our mission to forge ahead, close equity gaps, and advocate for every public school student in North Carolina to be empowered to accept academic challenges, prepared to pursue their chosen path after graduating from high school, and equipped to become lifelong learners. Now more than ever, we will guard and maintain the right of a sound basic education for every child in our North Carolina public schools. This public health crisis has necessitated innovation, and educators throughout North Carolina have, without hesitation, answered this call. All of this leads to our much-awaited reentry stage, when we will welcome our students back to our schools. Rest assured, we will operate our schools differently in the next school year, because the safety and security of your child and your child's teacher, in our eyes, demands nothing less.
That's Eric Davis, chairman of the State Board of Education. You also heard from State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Mark Johnson. Both are addressing North Carolina public schools' adaptation to life after the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Socialism has gained popularity in recent years within the Democratic Party and among young Americans, but our next guest has a warning for those who support socialism. Look at what happened to my country. Andres Guilarte is a political activist for the freedom of Venezuela. He recently spoke to students at North Carolina State University. If we read, listen to, or watch the news, we get a sense that conditions in Venezuela are bad. Is it really that bad?
News just maybe shows some stuff, but the reality is way worse. I mean, there is plenty of things that you could never imagine that are happening over there unless you actually speak to someone that comes from Venezuela or that you do a really deep research. So it's a subject that even though that people, you know, what they see, they think is bad, if they actually get to see what is going on inside the country, they will get terrified what is going on.
Tell us more.
For example, going outside and you see garbage in the street because there is the public services of garbage, they don't work. So there is plenty of garbage in the street, and there is families eating that garbage. And there is families that actually make schedules, so they wait till the restaurants take out their garbage so they can get a piece of that garbage. That's one of the examples. It may seem like a horror movie. Don't take for granted the small things you have. Because when you actually can get a meal, even if it's just one per day, because there is people that don't eat for 2-3 days in Venezuela, you have to be, you know, really thankful that you have it.
Some people are going to say, this is Venezuela. Hugo Chavez was bad. Nicolas Maduro is bad. You think it's more than just a couple of bad guys?
any government, doesn't matter how wealthy it looks, it can go down in a second, like Venezuela did. I mean, in the 70s, Venezuela was the richest country in Latin America, and the prospects were that it was going to be one of the richest in the world in the upcoming years. We used to be called, in the 80s, the Saudi Venezuela, like Saudi Arabia, the Venezuela Saudita, as they say in Spanish, because we had so much money from oil revenue that it was insane. And now you see what is going on in Venezuela. It's crazy. And that tells you that it doesn't matter how rich you are. You can be someone like, for example, Singapore. They don't have the same resources that Venezuela has, but they have plenty of more wealth in their values of their citizens that we have. That's the actual subject that should be learned from Venezuela.
You say Chavez, in some ways, was a response to bad policies of previous governments.
Chavismo is just the result of bad policies before then, of a constant growing that people has to be dependent on the government. There also other factors, for example, the government in those years, they didn't pay too much attention to the military factor. So Chavez used to be a military. And when he made the coup, and most of his fellows in the government, they're all militaries. So there is a number of factors that led to Chavez to appear. A lot of people, especially here in the U.S., they think that we just wake up and Chavez was there and socialists appear and everything went south. No, actually, there is a result of a series of effects before him. In Venezuela in the 90s, people actually used to say, something is going to happen if we allow this guy to get to power. And something happened. So if other countries can take the same lesson and try to see this stuff before it happens, you can avoid it. In Venezuela, we used to say, we are not going to be like Cuba. And in Cuba, they used to say, we're not going to be like any other country, like the URS or any other country that fell under socialism. If you think that you are immune to that evil, immune to that cancer that is socialism, that is bad policies, that is giving too much power to the government and to just repress the individual liberties, you are going to be ending way worse than where you're saying you're not. You have to pay attention to your surroundings, to your context, and don't take for granted the liberties that you have right now, because if you allow them to be taken from you, you're going to end up like us, where we're struggling every single day to maybe try to fight them back.
We're chatting with Andres Guilarte, freedom activist from Venezuela. I'm sure some people say to you, but we don't want Venezuelan socialism. We want socialism like the kind they have in Sweden, Norway, the Nordic model.
That's a common question in the presentations. Like, okay, that's the Venezuela socialism. That's what happened over there. What we're trying to do here is the Nordic model. That's Nordic socialism. But when you actually read and find how the Nordic countries are where they are today, it's because of a welfare state policies that they have, where after the fall of the Soviet Union, they just started a free market policies that engaged them in the wealth that they have right now. So that allowed them to have a safe net, which is the welfare state, which is way different than what is going on in Venezuela. So, and there is a lot of entrepreneurship in those Nordic countries. There is nothing in Venezuela. In socialism, entrepreneurship is like just taken away from the options, because that's not allowed in socialism. So when something wants to sell Nordic model, they're just selling you, like we say in Venezuela, they're selling you rabbits instead of, you know, cat. They're actually selling you Venezuela, not selling you Norway. You're not going to end up like Norway if you follow the Venezuelan policies.
You think there's a right way and a wrong way to combat socialism?
The wrong way is to think that underestimate socialism, underestimate that, no, we're not going to pay too much attention to that. And the problem in Venezuela is that in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, socialism was really popular in the universities. You have a lot of teachers that agreed in the Marxist way of thinking. And I see that has happened here in the U.S. too. A lot of in college, they have a lot of these teachers that they're trying to push forward in these ideas. And if you don't pay attention to that, those are the generations that are going to vote in the future. So that was one of the mistakes of the governments before Chavez. The other mistake was the handling of the economy. Eventually, if you handle bad your economy, people is going to try to find something outside your options. When people just fall off the trust of that system, they just seek for the outsider, which was Chavez. And Chavez just took the opportunity in that moment.
You also think it's a bad idea to try to shout down socialists.
Other people go to university campuses and they try to fight back the ideas, but I think they are doing it the wrong way, because when you just show up at university shouting facts to people, people is not going to just learn because you shout some facts again. You need to understand them. You need to speak with them respectfully. And maybe if they don't agree with you, they can disagree at the moment, but after you speak with them, you can find common spots. I think that that's one of the problems here in the U.S., that college students are not being heard in their problems. So they just seek the most opposite idea of the system, which is socialism. And that's something that it should be learned from Venezuela. You have to underestimate these people and just try to speak with them, how they can see the flaws of the system and try to work with that.
What do you think when you hear politicians say such great things about socialism?
I try not to speak directly about politicians because I'm not a U.S. citizen. So I cannot tell another U.S. citizen to how to use their rights to vote. But what we're doing is just, in other words, the same, because we're showing what is socialism. So the under message is like, don't vote for people who is doing the same stuff that we did. So when I hear some politicians, and I'm going to say the names because we're asking me directly, like Bernie or AOC, Bernie used to say, like, Chavez was a role model. In 2009, he used to say, like, Venezuela should be the role model that we should follow in the U.S., When you hear something like that, and you are Venezuelan, or if you are Cuban, which we're like our brothers against this evil, it's like you can't just stand down. You have to say, like, wait a minute, I'm from there, and this is what happened. And when you say something like that, you can see that it happens in social media. Some politicians, they just undermine what you're saying. Like, and that's where it comes, what you said. Okay, but that was your country. I'm following the Nordic model and all this and that. But in the end, you have to fight against that too. But it's really painful to see that they are trying to use our countries as a role model when we are leaving our countries to everyone we can. I mean, you don't see people immigrating to Venezuela or to Cuba. You see people leaving those countries.
That's Andres Guilarte, a freedom activist from Venezuela and a recent speaker at North Carolina State University. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Going over budget, failing to pay attention to spending, not a good recipe for running your own household or for the North Carolina Department of Transportation. But indeed, that is the conclusion about DOT by NC State Auditor Beth Wood. Here to discuss the recent audit released by the Auditor's Office is Rick Henderson, Editor-in-Chief of Carolina Journal. Carolina Journal reporting on the story. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
So how bad are the finances over at the Department of Transportation?
Very bad. And the thing that was particularly eye-opening about the audit report was that some of these issues have been out there for close to a year, that the department was improperly spending its budget, that it was basically had not allowed for reimbursing landowners under the MAP Act when the state Supreme Court had ruled some time ago that the state actually has to do this if the state takes someone's property for the purposes of building a highway and doesn't allow them the use of that property, even if the highway is never built, the state's still got to give you some money for it at some point, especially if you're still paying property taxes on it. So
they had this legal ruling, and they never even put into their budget
right.
the money that was going to be required to pay these property owners. So that was a factor in all this. And then apparently
yes.
they just didn't pay attention to spending on construction projects.
Yeah. The thing about the DOT is that it's, to some extent, it is self-funded through things like fuel taxes and registration fees and all that. But still, the actual allocation of money comes from the General Assembly. And so there are different pots of money that DOT receives, but still the General Assembly decides, okay, this amount of money needs to go for, let's say, maintenance and repairs. This sort of money goes to construction. Do you need us to borrow money for a project? Okay, if so, let us know, and then we'll, see if the local authority is going to do that or if we need to do it at the statewide level. But anyway, there are any sorts of decisions the General Assembly makes, and DOT essentially hasn't been abiding by them. And so that's caused some problems as well.
So they apparently had projects that they were just continuing to work on, maintaining roads, building some different things, and the money was flowing out, but it wasn't matching up with the money flowing in. And
right.
so now it's close to, what, about $750 million or so?
It's a pretty significant amount of money, and that's about right. And so the problems are that there have not been safeguards in place for the longest time. Members of the General Assembly, normally speaking, tend not to be really critical of these sorts of things because it's highway projects are kind of like military bases. You always want one in your district, and you want projects to increase mobility, to be sure, because that's the purpose of having this done at the statewide level. But also at the same time, there may be a bypass that you want or something like that that may not necessarily improve mobility all that much, but that may be something you can hang your hat on and say, oh, I've gone to a ribbon cutting and we have this spiffy new bridge or whatever. And so the sort of the non-glamorous stuff, like the repairs and maintenance, those are the sorts of things that have been shortchanged. Now, the DOT also said that we've had several massive hurricanes hit North Carolina over the past 3 or 4 years, and we've allocated for the normal level of hurricane impact, but we've gotten socked several times with bigger ones than were expected. And so we actually had to funnel some money or at least, let some projects stay on hold and other things to take care of this disaster relief. That's a legitimate point. But then again, the General Assembly has been allocating money for disaster relief or has been reallocating the DOT's own budget for that. And so the audit still said that things weren't quite copacetic there.
What's the consequence of this? I mean, in my household, if I were to do something like this, I'd have to shut off the cable or not go out and buy the fancy meat, maybe buy a hamburger for dinner.
Right.
You make up. In other words, you don't spend as much. Well, are they just not going to spend as much, or are they asking for additional money?
Well, they're asking for one thing. They are asking for some additional money. They also have laid off some contract employees as well. And so some of the road builders and other folks like that, some of those projects have just been delayed and those folks have been laid off. Although, again, the audit sort of said, well, if you'd actually done your job right, you wouldn't need to do this now. There's another issue in that the DOT headquarters is supposed to be moved from Raleigh to Rocky Mount. And that's been delayed by COVID-19, and there's some sort of question about how fast that's going to take place. Officials, both the DOT and some lawmakers who've been looking at this have said everything's on schedule. It's going to happen, but it remains to be seen if they're going to be able to make that happen.
Is that supposed to take place sometime in 2020?
That's supposed to be underway. I mean, that sort of transfer is supposed to be in the works right now, and that's been waylaid a little bit by COVID-19.
And presumably that costs money as well.
Oh, sure.
Move people, change your operations, et cetera.
Yeah, that was the sort of thing that was a bit controversial at the time it happened. Then again, there are a number of folks. I mean, we're seeing this happen at the federal level that not every agency needs to be in the capital city. And the thought was by moving the DOT headquarters to Rocky Mount, for one thing, you might be able to take advantage of a workforce that might not demand the same level of wages and benefits as, let's say, people in Raleigh would. You might be able to attract, a higher quality of employee for lower money if you go to outside of Raleigh. And so that's one of the reasons for the move.
Rick, what was the reaction of the Department of Transportation's leadership to this really searing audit out of State Auditor Beth Wood's office?
They accepted all the findings. They did say, Eric Boyette, who's the transportation secretary, said, basically said, we don't really quibble with the findings, but that they cited the high spending for disaster relief and the fact that they did have to make these MAP Act payments, even though they were supposed to, but they still said, we had to pay for MAP Act. Also said that they needed to have more money available for maintenance and repairs. That needed to be higher appropriation for that so that they didn't need to so that they could make sure that they could rebuild that budget. Typically, when we have had recessions or economic downturns, one of the things that suffers a lot is transportation spending, especially for projects for just maintenance and repairs, because people say, we're not replacing a bridge that's out. We're simply not going to repair this bridge right now. It'll be okay. And when those things build up, you have some serious problems down the road. You've got to spend that money eventually.
Are they in line for any federal money? We've seen several different packages come out of the federal government during COVID-19. Will they get any cash infusion?
Maybe in a future spending package. There's possible that you will see some of that in the it's possible you'll see some of that in the existing legislation. Our CEO here, Amy Cook, has gotten together with the Platt Institute in Nebraska and has asked Congress for some flexibility to allow states to backfill budgets where they had basically were expecting to get money in, and then all of a sudden tax collections dropped off to zero. And so there's, I think, $300 million or something like that in the package that the General Assembly passed, but that's contingent on Congress giving them that flexibility. So the money's going to be coming in, and they're going to get some relief. It's just a question basically of how soon, and is it going to be from something that's already been appropriated by Congress, or if it's going to be some new funny money coming in from Washington.
Well, exactly. And of course, as you mentioned, part of their funding mechanism is gas taxes. Carolina Journal has been reporting on the audit that was issued by Beth Wood's office. Rick Henderson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.